Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dialect Coach's Corner podcast, the place where we love talking about language and the way people speak it. I'm Jerome Butler, your dialect coach, and we're down here today in the Big Easy, Crescent City, La Nouvelle Orléans, New Orleans, Louisiana. And I'm very pleased to have as my guest today on the podcast an extremely talented actor and writer who has made his mark on the Broadway stage and major motion pictures and has starred in some of the most popular shows on television. You've seen him in The Chosen, Taps, Miami Vice, Natural Born Killers, Ransom, The Three Stooges, Law and Order, Hot Properties, The West Wing, Sex and the City, the series, and the two movies, Necessary Roughness, Californication, and he's down here in New Orleans working on a new ABC series, The Astronaut Wives Club. If we had a studio audience, they'd be putting their hands together right now for my good friend, my brother from another, Evan Handler. Welcome to the podcast, Evan.
Thank you very much, Drum. I'm going to have to amp up the energy, I think. You got a rap going. I just arrived here, you know, as a simple old me.
That's exactly what we want. Now, how have you been finding your time down here in New Orleans?
That's a loaded question. New Orleans is beautiful. It's beautiful, but I've been really in and out of town, so I haven't delved deep.
You know, this is a question that I have asked musicians. I hear that train coming.
Yeah, there's trains, there's boats.
Yes, there's a lot of activity in this city. I mean, this is a port city.
I get a big sense of that. I mean, I was staying in an area called the Bywater, and I actually had to leave because every day some funky tar smell floated in. And I couldn't figure out if it's because of oil field drilling or some industry in the neighborhood or the ships that pass about 200 feet away. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of gunk going in and out of here. They might put some of it in the food. I don't know. they're working with some voodoo mojo, you know. They got their ways down here.
I think that's what you call a gumbo.
A gumbo. I had some of that just before coming by today.
What are some of your earliest memories of voices or accents that you have?
That's a hard question for me to answer. You know, the only thing that comes to mind, really, two things, I guess. There was a woman who helped care for my mother and her sister as a child, who then cared for me and my siblings as a child. And she worked in my grandmother's house, then she worked in my parents' house, and then even when my parents moved up the river out of New York City, she commuted on a train. So I remember her voice, but it's the only really thing that I remember as... See, really what I remember is when I heard other kinds of voices and other kinds of accents, I would mimic them more then than I do now, that's for sure. As a kid, I did that a lot. And her name was Louise Anthony. And I remember her saying to me repeatedly all the time, she would say, "Boy, you got a hard head. You got a hard head." And I didn't even really know what it meant until, you know, I became an adult.
Yeah.
I thought, that's interesting. My head is hard, you know. But I remember I used to mimic that, you know, little saying of Louise's, and they'd get a good chuckle from my family. They thought it was dead on, you know, or I don't know if they thought it was dead on or cute to see the little kid doing that.
You know, it's funny because one of the earliest ones that I remember for me, I used to do an impression of Jimmy Durante. Mm-hmm. And I must have seen a comedian do it on television or something. But what was interesting about it, I have no idea how good it was, but to my ear, it was wonderful.
Right. You know, when around 11 years old, I don't remember, but when George McGovern was running for president, I would imitate him. My friends' families would get a big kick out of it. They would say, "Oh, that's good. That's good." They were really surprised to see this really skinny, waifish, long-haired boy do this imitation. And I say I used to do that stuff more because when I moved into the world and surrounded myself with professional actors who really are really good at that stuff, I stopped doing it. I did it because the people around me seemed to think it was really something special.
Yes.
And when I realized that it wasn't, I wasn't interested in doing it anymore.
Well, that's unfortunate in a way.
It is, you know, yeah, in a way.
Do you still remember your George McGovern impression?
Not well enough to do.
Because
I do remember it was sort of squelched like that and kind of, I don't even know what he sounds like anymore. But I do remember putting it really forward into their front teeth And yes. Something about an S like that and a really kind of squelched something. And if I heard him now and he sounded like that, I'd say, oh, hot damn. But I don't even remember.
I think you're onto something because I'm sort of reaching back to my own memories of George McGovern. And I think that you're onto something about the region that he was from.
Oh,
and,
yeah. Well, Minnesota, right?
Yeah. I think right? Upper Midwest someplace.
So that was a really big part. Mimicry was a big part of me growing up. I latched onto the fact that I could hear and mimic sounds in a way that got a good response from other people. Mm-hmm. So I remember that more than, you know, the train passing in the night or the birds in the morning. I remember people's voices and thinking, oh, I can sort of get the essence of that person. And latched onto that for a while. That was early performing for me. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't analyzing the sounds. Right. I just knew that I could hear it and sort of do it. You know, everything I just said about George McGovern when I said front, forward in the teeth, and I don't know.
You weren't thinking of any of that.
I wouldn't have said that at the time at 11 years old, I don't think.
Who were some of the actors that you admired when you were younger?
I don't think I'm alone in that I came of age in the, you know, becoming fascinated by the Sidney Lumet, Al Pacino collaborations through the 70s, Dustin Hoffman, you know, that revolution of short anti-hero guys.
Yes.
Who, from certain reports I read, were really astonished and congratulating themselves on becoming leading men. But that was the stuff that hooked me. And I had my own take and have come to have my own take on what it was. It's not that I ever heard Lumet or any of those guys describe it this way, but I remember going to see Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon. It actually wasn't until later that I saw Midnight Cowboy. But I thought what I became interested in as an actor was showing people truths that they would rather not see, but packaged in a fashion that was entertaining enough that they didn't want to look away. And that was the way to subversively make commentary and tell great stories that had import. So that was totally it for me. And in relating it to, I think, the topic you want to get into, I mean, Dustin Hoffman has always been a fascinating actor to me in that, well, look, I was a stage actor for 10 years professionally, you know, besides training and stuff. And then I started doing some film and television. And it was always and continues to be a struggle to me modulating stuff on film. Modulating stuff here, talking into a microphone. Mm-hmm. Giving interviews was a brand new thing. And realizing that, oh, this is a whole trip of how to sound casually intimate, but still alive without really, really reducing the range of your voice.
Right.
The vocal range, you know, my vocal range gets incredibly compressed and diminished talking to a microphone like this. Especially wearing cups like we're doing, because mm-hmm. I hear my voice is huge.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm not as effusive as I think I might be otherwise. But Dustin Hoffman, I don't know what he does, and I don't know what's on his mind, because I've never had a conversation with the guy. But Dustin Hoffman accomplishes tremendous amounts, seemingly, without getting any bigger than a very kind of deep, soft, internal thing.
Like,
he's a guy who seems to me he does not project for a microphone or a camera. When I do that, or have attempted to do that, I think I come off as deadly dull. I have really found, going back years, that in order for me to have some kind of spark on film, that I really have to have very strong motivation and oomph behind what I do to make it pop in any way.
You're actually getting into something that I was very interested in talking about in terms of, because you have done so much theater, and now you primarily, you know, are working, you know, in front of a camera.
And I've recorded books, which is not easy to do.
Yes.
And they're my own books, which should be easy to do. I can't stand to listen to my recording of my first book.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
That was Time on Fire?
Yeah, and it's right. A story that started me sitting on a stage alone telling it to people, but not into a microphone.
Yes.
In a muffled booth.
I think the first line of the play, when I saw you do it, was, "It is not good news."
I'm afraid it is not good news, is what he said. Sort of gets you right in there.
So let's just take that particular line, because I mean,
for those who don't know, it's a doctor speaking.
Yes.
It's not the words you want to hear a doctor say.
No. those are not the words you want to hear a doctor say.
Right.
And this was a play that you had created based on a book that you had written?
No, actually the opposite.
Okay.
I wanted to write a book. I was an actor who was known around New York. I had a reputation already. I mean, people around New York would stop me and say, hey, are you Evan Handler? Just from doing stage work. And I wanted to write a book about these experiences, and I thought, well, I mean, I can try to write a book proposal and send it to publishing houses, or I could write a really, really condensed version of it and invite those people to come see an actor they're familiar right. with and aware of to the theater and see if I could get them to attend and become interested in the material that way. And, but anyway, it turned into a production at a major off-Broadway theater, and it did work. I did get the book deal that way from someone that I didn't invite.
Yes.
Who came on their own.
Yes.
And so then I began the process of expanding and telling the whole story that I had originally written as an extremely condensed version.
So let's just take that line, because that was the opening of a performance in front of a live audience. So there's a certain amount of sharing and vocal sharing that is required in a theater. And now you're talking about having difficulty sort of modulating this when you're actually reading the audiobook version. I'm just curious about sort of taking that as a jumping off point in talking about what are some of the challenges that you, I mean, first of all, what did you learn about your communicating that worked in the theater, and then how it didn't quite work, or how you had to change it when...
It's really hard for me to be able to talk to a microphone and sound like I'm communicating directly and personally to one other person. Mm. I'm still really taken by good voiceover, narration. I'm talking about films. I'm not talking about Liev Schreiber doing an HBO thing. But I'm talking about somebody who's telling their story and their internal monologue as the film is going on. I don't even know who to mention that I think has done it in exemplary fashion. I just know whenever I've tried to do it, it sounds to me, it sounds really stilted, careful, and precious, and not what I want it to be. It's a difficult state to get myself into to just talk easily mm-hmm. in relaxed fashion conversationally when I'm hearing myself through the headphone, and have that consistently be projected as thoughts you really want someone to understand the point you're trying to make.
Yes.
It was a challenge. I mean, then when you're doing a book, it's a whole other thing, because you're also, you stop every time you swallow, at least back when I did it. Because right. I got hired to do one of the early books on tape. I recorded Goodbye Columbus. Again, this is something that happened to me before I had my wits about me to even know, well, this is kind of an incredible piece. You know, what are we doing here? The entire atmosphere felt very constricted and constrictive. And there was that battle of how to do it. I'm kind of bouncing all over here, but it's the same. I have the same struggles with a camera, and really become interested in a question I've never asked some of these guys. But you know, microphones exist, video cameras exist, but I've never been a guy who sits down with a microphone and a video camera and tests out what I think I'm going to do for a role.
Right.
I don't put myself on tape before auditions, but at the same time as I'm not doing it, I think, how incredibly foolish, how stupid is that? I mean, are you really relying on that old dictum from the 1970s, like when you came up as an actor and were training as an actor, that if it feels right, then that's what's right? Because I got news for you, that ain't the case.
Right.
You know, it can feel as right as you want. It might not be right. And it doesn't have to feel right.
It may not read.
I grew up with a brother who was training to be a photojournalist, and I know from those photographs, you know, when someone goes out and shoots 12 hours of pictures, they want a sad face to show a person's emotions at the demonstration for the people who got killed. They're going to use any picture that looks sad. Mm. It doesn't matter if that person just sneezed.
Right.
It doesn't matter if that person is crying because something went in their eye. Morally, they're not going to use a picture from a rock concert that happened the night before,
right?
Because that would not be proper.
Right.
But if they were in the right place, it doesn't matter what motivated that expression. You know, and I'm very curious, you know, when Johnny Depp, does Johnny Depp bring Jack Sparrow from his mind and say, well, this is how I think it ought to be, and then just does it the first day of filming? I'd be surprised if that's the case. that versus Edward Scissorhands, you know, these kind of stylized performances.
Right, right.
Is he really relying on, yeah, this must be right because it feels right? Or is he spending how many days or weeks checking himself out and seeing, well, what if I do this? And what if I do that? And what if I do that? And if he, and I'm just using his name because it popped into my head, but if he and other people are doing that and I'm not, what kind of joke am I playing on myself?
Well, it's certainly true that either the camera captures it or it doesn't. I mean, there's a great story that was told to me by wonderful actor Chris Allport, who was working with James Woods. They did this scene, and when it was done, Chris said, "Wow, that was really great." And James said, "Yeah, yeah, I hope they got it." Because either you get it or you don't. It doesn't matter what it feels like.
Everybody has a different level that reads on film and on microphone. There are people whose natural bearing and voice are so authoritative that they don't have to do much of anything to be authoritative. There are other people who really would have to manipulate themselves, their voices, and their essences in order to be authoritative, or the opposite. I have noticed myself there are vast differences between what I experience is going on and what a camera or a microphone actually pick up, and that I've never reached a comfort level of working with the technology to really come to learn what is my neutral state and what efforts do I need to make to modulate that to have the effects that I think I'm having and that I want to have. Now, I've done it simply because I've appeared on film a lot of times, right, and done a lot of interviews, so I've had feedback that way. I just haven't done it in my mad scientist laboratory at home. And the one thing that I have learned is that I really kind of need to put a lot behind it for it to read. There was one take I remember from Sex and the City, and I was just kind of hanging out shirtless under a tree because the joke of the day was a horrible rash on my back, so there was a lot of plastic makeup on my back. We did what I thought was a rehearsal for the cameras, and then they said, "Okay, got it, moving on." And I said, whoa, that was the take, because the camera was very far away. They were using a long lens. He said, "Yep," and it was great. And the director actually made a comment that he liked it better than the takes where I knew the camera was rolling. So, you know, there's both sides of the coin. You know, I would like to be able to do what it seems to me Dustin Hoffman does. I mean, not that he doesn't get big and you know, elaborate himself. I mean, look at Ratso Rizzo. I mean, look at him in Dick Tracy. You know, these are not naturalistic performances. I mean, actually, Ratso Rizzo is, but it's not like Dustin Hoffman when he wakes up in the morning. It's a whole turn, you know, a whole character turn. But I'm fascinated by how much just being there and being present would be enough. Or am I just an actor that doesn't work for? Because I know I don't feel comfortable with it. I feel like more is necessary. I think to a certain segment of people who are watching and probably a certain segment of directors, they prefer less. You know, I happen to be interested. I'm interested in craft, and I'm interested in somebody kind of working the material. Mm-hmm. You know, I like the cleverness behind things when I can see it. So I certainly enjoy purely behaved, naturalistic stuff. But when an actor is able to be naturalistic and filled with really truthful behavior that also gives some commentary on the material and on the character, that I like that. So naturally, that's what I try to bring to it. Right. I like to infuse what I do with, you know, what I think is interesting human insight and cleverness and twists and unexpected stuff, if you can find it. That's the goal to me. But that's, I guess, the fine line between a mannered, studied performance and an inspired performance.
After a quick break, we'll get into that and more with Evan Handler.